of things, cross-disciplinary collaboration for teaching colors in Menominee. And we're going to start out by doing something that we actually had come up with before we came here, but it feels much more appropriate now that we're actually here, which is we decided we should introduce ourselves. So I'm Monica McCauley, and I'm a linguist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I do language documentation, description, and analysis.
Hello, and I'm Rita McDonald, and I'm an applied linguist at the University of Wisconsin. And on behalf of me and my colleague, I want to thank the people for having us here, and we are grateful to stand on this beautiful land of Hawaii and to be invited to learn with the people. Thank you for having us.
Okay, so I'm going to start off by telling you a little bit of background about Menominee. So Menominee is an Algonquian language of Wisconsin, and if you are familiar with the state of Wisconsin, here's where it is in the state. That's the Menominee Reservation that's circled there. The language was documented very extensively between 1921 and 1949 by Leonard Bloomfield, and I've been working with the community since 1998. The current status of the language is not great. The official line right now is that there are maybe possibly five L1 speakers. I only know one, and she's 90. So I'm not actually sure how many speakers there are besides her. There's a small number of proficient L2 speakers, and actually a very definitely growing community of second language speakers, and I'm very happy about that. But the number of proficient ones is fairly small. One of the things about Menominee that's different from some of the nearby related languages like Ojibwe is that there's no external communities of speakers. So the Menominee Reservation is it. This is where the speakers are, if there are any. So there's a current project underway, started in January of 2016, a tribal program to train the teachers. Basically what it is it's immersion for immersion teachers. So they're training them to speak Menominee, and they're doing this 14-month immersion. And specifically right now, they're training them to become teachers for preschool immersion. And when you think preschool immersion, you think colors, right? I mean, little kids, that's one of the things you teach. It's a customary part of the pre-K curriculum. It's concrete, easily cued, and all of that. Well, I've actually tried helping out in creating lessons about teaching colors once before. This was about 10 years ago. And there was a doctoral student in curriculum and instruction at UW-Madison, who I will just call CL. And she was really interested in intergenerational transmission of language. She had no training in linguistics. She had some SLA training, and she had this idea of doing a lesson on colors as a sample lesson for teachers, sort of to model how to do a lesson. So she came up with this list of sentences that she wanted me to translate. So the sentences were things like, what color do you see? I see orange. What's your favorite color? My favorite color is blue. Touch someone wearing red. Touch someone wearing a red shirt. And these are perfectly reasonable sentences from an English point of view. But I couldn't do it. they're really, really complicated in English. I mean, in Menominee. So what I'm going to do next is I'm going to tell you a little bit about how you express colors in Menominee, and I promise there's no quiz at the end or anything. I just want to give you some sense of what the complexity is, and I'm just going to sort of try to run through it as fast as I can. There's three strategies. There's pronouns, there's verbs, and there's what I call the looks like construction. And I'll start with the pronouns. They compound with the following noun, and there's a very limited set. There's just four: black, white, green, and blue, or sort of a dark color. So here's an example. Apesoasa means black bear, and the apes is the black in that. So that's the pronouns. Then there's verbs, also a limited subset duplicates the pronouns. So there's a be black, be white, be green, and be blue or be dark colored. And then to that, it adds be red, be yellow or brown, and be brown. Now, this is complicated quite a bit by some cross-cutting categories. So first of all, there's a different form for attributive versus predicative uses. So that's two forms per color. And then Menominee has two noun classes. They have animacy. So there's animate and inanimate. So that means that there is a separate verb depending on the animacy of the object. So that's another two verbs per color. And 2 times 2 is 4. So that means that for these 7 colors, you've got at least 4 forms to learn. So here's a little comparison of the pronouns and, or yeah, the pronouns and the verbs. So a pesoasa is a black bear, like I told you. The attributive verb, awasa pesanet, that would be a black bear. So it means the same thing. Presumably, at some point in the past, there was a difference between the pronoun and the attributive verb use, but that's lost. I don't know what the difference would be. And then the predicative verb is a pesanawasa. So that would be the bear is black. And you can see that obviously the words, the pronouns and the verbs are related, but they're not exactly the same forms. Oh, and I was also going to mention that the word order is fairly flexible. Oh, we just got kicked off the internet here, but hopefully that'll be okay. Yeah, okay. Something just flashed up on the screen. Oh yeah, I was going to say something about the word order. It's fairly flexible. I think this is probably the least marked order, but I'm not entirely sure. Okay, and then there's the looks like construction. So for any other color, what you do is you say that the thing you're talking about looks like some other object, or the color of some other object. So for example, if you want to say something is purple, you say it looks like grape. So the problem here is that I've only ever found this in four objects. And so I found somen, which is grape, for purple, asketamen for orange, and that's actually the word for the fruit, and it's used for the color orange, kasik sky for light blue, and osonamon, which is vermilion, which is a bright red, and this is actually the name of a plant, and that's where that comes from. So a couple of examples of the looks like construction. Somen se nako se wok nyasyuk. That's a hard word to say. The mittens are purple. And you can see it's got grape in there. The mittens look like grape. Or wiyakpun askatamen esinakwit. The hat is orange. So the first one has an animate noun, and so you can see the form of the verb there. And the second one has an inanimate noun, and you can see that the verb is related, but it does change a bit, and that has to do with the animacy. So this is a schematic of the different strategies. The verb in its attributive and predicative forms, and then the looks like construction, they all make distinctions between animate and inanimate, but the pronouns don't change at all. There's no difference whether it's animate or inanimate. So here presumably is how the listener would, the learner, would perceive the task that they have in learning this. They'd say, okay, great. There's 4 colors, and there are 2 different strategies, verb and pronoun, and there's 5 different forms. The next 3 colors, there's 1 strategy, but there's 4 different forms. And then these other 4 colors, there's just 1 strategy, but there's 2 forms. So it's obviously pretty daunting. It's not an easy system. There are 2 current approaches that have been taken to trying to teach these colors. First of all, various teachers are providing lists of color terms, and what they're doing is they're treating them as if they're English adjectives. So you get things like this. Here what we've got is we've got a picture of an orange, and then it says orange table, but it means orange the fruit table. And then orange, the fruit butterfly, and then we've got grape, and we have grape table and grape butterfly. So obviously they're just doing it completely off of English. Now here's a kind of an interesting issue. The Menominee Language and Culture Commission is a tribally appointed body which oversees everything having to do, obviously, obviously with language and culture, and they want the colors taught correctly, as they put it. In other words, they want them to be taught, they want the teachers to learn to do them the old way and then to pass that on. And I was just in Kathy's talk, and there was a lot of discussion about the whole issue of language change. And I realized that this raises all sorts of issues, but for us, we're doing what the Language and Culture Commission wants us to do, so that's how it's been decided. Now, the other current approach to teaching the colors is mine. So I said, oh, I can explain this. And I did prose descriptions of all of the possibilities. And then I gave examples of all of the possibilities. And then I gave tables. So my tables looked like this. And I thought to myself, this is brilliant. It's so clear. I mean, it's examples. It's perfect. And the answer was no. No, Monica. That doesn't help at all. So instead, I brought my colleague Rita in.
So we decided to take advantage of a new collaboration that we had. We've been working together for about a year. We came together for a different reason. We did not come together to teach colors, but we decided we would work together. Now here, you saw earlier, here's the configuration of who we are. Monica's training, she talked about, but she has no training in second language acquisition. My training is primarily in second language acquisition. But way back in the day, I did have some structural linguistics classes, but I've never used them. And so I've forgotten more than I ever learned. And for the last 12 years, I've been very English focused. So we found that we did not even have the same meta language. The language we used to talk about language, we didn't have enough overlap to talk to one another. When Monica said predicative, and I say predicative, we mean something very different. So this was not working. And then you put us together with a group of teacher trainees. None of them are teachers. None of them are linguists. They are all fluent in English, although not perhaps standard English. But they are fluent in English, but we don't know what meta language they have. And it is no longer safe to say that someone coming through an English medium of instruction understands the terminology noun and adjective, because we don't teach grammar in English anymore. So we're starting from scratch. So we decided to just own up to the fact that we were starting from scratch. And we were just going to start with our foundational principles and see what we could do. So here, of course, a foundational principle of linguistics: always be descriptive, never prescriptive. From applied linguistics, always attend to students' meaning over correctness. Well, we were not able to stick with that. Because, as Monica said, these trainees are actually, they're being pressed into service now. They are out there on the front lines having to do this. So we had no time for the immersion-friendly, slow development of relevant metalinguistic categories. You know, eventually they'll evolve. We didn't have time for that. We had no time for the slow approximation of correctness. When we focus on form, we trust that correctness will come. If there's enough experience in various contexts, no time for that. They were out there and they needed to be doing it correctly. So the big question for us was, what teaching sequence might facilitate their rapid and correct learning of this? So, principles from second language acquisition. We decided we would use some of those. We're going to assess their prior knowledge. So what shared knowledge might we all be, our strange geometric shapes, what might we have together? Well, since they're English fluent, we were going to see whether what we knew that they had, the form of noun adjective pairing, they got that. What meta language did they use for that? We could tap into that, right? And then use their meta language rather than trying to force them to learn my meta language or Monica's meta language, presuming we could even remember one another's. And then we were going to build on those strengths. And we decided also to focus on function and connect then to form. And I draw there from systemic functional linguistics, Halliday and Hassan. I think it was Hassan who, speaking about children, said, children do not choose form, they choose function. function. So we developed a very clear set of systematic lessons, and I'll just go through them rather quickly. We were going to start with finding out what their meta-language is for noun and adjective, and use that to teach the attributive form, and then back up and teach the simpler form. Once they had mastered that, we were then going to move to the predicative and establish meta-language for predicative in terms of function. What is it doing here that's different than what it's doing over there? Hat, black hat, hat is black. How do you talk about how that is different? And then from there, we were going to keep building and reinforcing the form and function pairing. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip ahead to reality. You know what they say about plans, right? Well, all of a sudden, the trainees with whom we were going to be working were not there. They were out, and we did get to have an afternoon with them. So looking ahead to the next group of trainees who will be coming on board soon, we decided, well, let's do a little probe to see if our approach has any utility. Is this feasible? And so we decided that we would do a formative probe, jumping into the middle of our lesson sequence. We would give them sentence cards that were both attributive and predicative, all mixed up, and see if they could sort them. And if they were able to sort them, what language did they use to describe what was happening? What categories were they finding, and how did they talk about those categories? What we wanted to see was, would this activity of sorting prompt a movement into a metalinguistic space? Did it elicit a natural metalanguage? And was it a metalanguage that was effective when shared with others? So we did that. First, we gave them monomany phrases, had them sort them into categories, and explained how they did that. We didn't give them any clues. We didn't tell them how many categories. They could just do whatever they needed to. One pair derived a predicative attributive sort right away. Everyone else did something different. Some stayed very superficial and weren't metalinguistic at all the first time. They sorted black and white, or animate, well, some animate and inanimate. So then we said, great, there are so many ways to sort language. Again, no clues, no cues. Do it differently this time. And we were going to keep doing it differently to see how many people would derive that. Well, we then, after a couple of sorts, had everyone go back to listen to the meta language of the group that had done the predicative attributive sort. We said, how did you sort that out in your head? What did you call those things? Oh, well, the attributive was just, oh, that's just describing something. The other one is telling something about it. So, describing, telling something about. So we said to everyone, okay, can you sort the cards that way? And bing, they all did. So it was a meta language that worked. So we now have these conclusions. Okay, there we go. I'm lagged, haven't had enough caffeine. So we did find that our sorting activity was successful at moving people into a metalinguistic space. We were able to derive a meaningful metalanguage very quickly. This was a 15-minute activity. The metalanguage made sense to other people, and it was effective for them. So we believe that there is strong potential for using this approach when we work with the next set of trainees. But what was really interesting was that the sorting and the discussion about the categorizations prompted even new, unelicited learning from the trainees. As they were reflecting on how the language was doing something different, they noticed things that they had not noticed before. They noticed things that they had not been taught. So it elicited a curiosity about them. And there are some who say that to learn grammar, to teach grammar, you want to get students to notice what language is doing. So that was a very important thing that started in their heads. Mm-hmm. And we look forward to capitalizing on that in the future. And so what we learned, that this group of trainees had significant meta language that can now be used to hasten their learning, should the tribe decide to go in that direction.
And then very quickly, just a meta conclusion. It's difficult, if not impossible, for one person to fill all of these roles. So I started thinking about it as a different kind of lone wolf approach. Many of us know about the whole lone wolf thing. Linguists like me need help with all of the aspects of language pedagogy in order to be useful to a language reclamation project. Linguists and educators like Rita need help understanding the language structures in order to be useful to a language reclamation project. And so we just need more interdisciplinary collaboration. Well, Anne.
So we welcome your ideas and your questions, or to hear about your own experiences and things like this.
Did you?
Yes.
Yeah, this isn't directly relevant to your topic, but it is about categorization. So unless I completely misunderstood your examples, you had two categories, animate and inanimate, and car versus hat. Well, car, I guess I could imagine that car might be in some sense animate.
It's because it moves.
Mittens.
Yeah, but it's not always logical.
Yeah.
Well,
like,
no, I know. So I was,
yeah.
Just, you know. So how do you teach that if you're calling them? And I mean, I can deal with arbitrary names for things.
Yeah.
But I was curious as to why it's called animate, inanimate, and how you teach that if that's the terminology you need.
Yeah. It is mostly okay. That's not showing up on the screen. It's just showing up here. thanks. It is mostly what, with my Western worldview, I would say is intuitive. There are also many culturally relevant things that are animate, so things like everything having to do with tobacco is animate, because tobacco is sacred, so sacred things are animate. For the most part, it's fairly easy to predict. And then there are just all of these little random things, like, for example, raspberry is animate and strawberry is inanimate. Just have to learn it.
I just think this is really, really cool because I'm Potawatomi and like,
oh
yeah, from here by there. So yeah, it is kind of arbitrary. You're right. It's just really interesting because when I was little and I went to like Head Start, they like tried to teach us these things and I remember it, but they would just completely forego like any like notion of like trying to like teach us, you know, verbs that go along with it and just kind of made them to adjectives. And like now that I think about that right now, I'm thinking that's. It was very confusing for at least like me later on, but this is a big like current like pedagogical issue, like where I'm from, not up in Forest County, but like in Michigan.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Question here. Yeah, I think the point that you made about not everybody even understand like has adjective as a category. Like I don't know, maybe this is a younger generation thing. I remember being taught adjectives, and I know that. Like some people that work on languages that quote unquote don't have adjectives start getting all crazy because they can't find the adjectives in their language.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering about like using this to not for I want to say naive, but not in the bad way. You know, like people who don't already have those. If they do have those categories, does it make sense to kind of try to override those so that they can actually start to work within their language and not get frustrated?
Well, that's interesting. And in our case, we weren't trying to elicit the title adjective.
Mm-hmm.
We were just wanting to get them to say whatever, however
right.
they thought about that. But yeah, it certainly doesn't make sense to impose an external meta language, but rather to elicit what's there.
Well, and also Menominee doesn't have adjectives, so.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, although they try to make them into adjectives,
yeah, right, yeah.
They don't have adjectives.
Yeah. The little picture from the workbook that I showed you,
yeah.
You know, great butterfly.
Yeah.
I mean, this is really interesting, and I'm guessing, obviously, the next step, these teachers were obviously going to go into, like, preschool classrooms,
yes.
Right? So they're probably not going to be teaching the preschool children. This is a, you know, this
no.
is a pre-noun or whatever, right?
Right.
Then I'm just wondering if there are thoughts or interest on sort of what the steps for the preschool kids like, because are they going to just sort of use all of these all together? Is it going to be like, you know, what the examples that they pick that have the different kinds of the kids?
Yeah, well, it's an immersion program.
Right.
So what we want is for the teachers to be using them correctly,
mm-hmm.
so that the children from infancy on are hearing the correct form and and then they will have time to develop the slow metalinguistic understanding and correctness.
And I'm gonna put the scare quotes around correct. It's an issue for me, but it's what they want us to do. So,
yeah.
I just wanted some of the examples of stuff like you have the third category of colors, like the looks like something, right? And it reminds me of questions I've had dealing with other languages and like teaching language learners and stuff that you know, if you have your L1 and you want to ask, okay, in the language of learning, how do I say this? Sometimes maybe the best answer is, well, you don't really. You wouldn't say that, right? And I'm wondering, you know, is there a discussion about, so, you know, purple is a basic color in English that any 5-year-old, you know, needs to know, but maybe in Manami that's not a color that you would be using, and maybe it's not important to, you know, make, you know, this is a basic thing you need to know. Children, you know, a 4-year-old needs to know how to say this in Menominee, because maybe it's just not, there's other words that you would use instead.
You and then me.
Well, what's interesting about that is we don't really know what children would do in Menominee, because we have no fluent speakers. So they're living in an English-centered world. So, yeah, but it's a question we've wondered about, too. And even, would Menominee parents teach their children colors? Mm-hmm. We don't know.
But these English-speaking...
Yeah.
Menominee people would, so yeah. So, and actually, that's so funny because it's so close to what we were talking about during Kathy's talk. Just, you know, this generation of speakers is not the same as the prior generations of fluent Menominee speakers. So,
yeah, fascinating question.
Yeah, it's very complicated, and
yeah,
I
shouldn't be asking questions.
Oh,
I was suggesting things, but I worked with children in schoolyard situations where they play their games.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the games which I worked on was a game with several girls in two groups. And it was about one of the groups that was representing the mother. And they said, I lost my daughter. Who is your daughter? And she would say, oh, she's the one with the white shirt, she's the one with the blue pants, and so on. And you would have to guess, I mean, the girl would have herself to guess, and she when she was the one who was selected, she would go to the mother's group. So I'm just mentioning that colors can be learned also through those schoolyard games that maybe elders remember, even if they if they're not fluent speakers anymore. So it might be a way to get activities for school children around colors that make sense.
Thank you.
Yeah,
so
thank you.
Yeah.
Someone.
Yeah, you tackle colors, but there's also numbers and size.
Oh, no, we're not going there.
I know.
Yeah, no, but colors are just, I think it's just sort of emblematic of how incredibly complicated something can be that you just, it doesn't cross your mind if you're an English speaker that it's going to be this incredibly complicated thing.
And is there thought to why it was developed that way? Like what were our ancestors doing that it has been developed that way?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question.
Because we have to think differently, right?
Yeah, well,
our
no. Or maybe once you are fully fluent, then you are thinking that way. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. We are one last comment and then we're done.
I thought this was a wonderful paper. Thank you so much. And I'm very interested in this technique of having the group try to see what are the distinctions they can see. So you did that. You said it was just a short meeting, right? You're going to try it again with the next group.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, have you thought of other structural distinctions beyond the predicative attributive that you think it might also work for? Are there other constructions that you want people to be able to, I mean, outside the realm of color maybe, or within it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the short answer to that is no, but the longer answer is I have this whole list of complicated Algonquian structures in my head, and I just every now and then go, oh my God, how are we going to teach them that?
Yeah.
So,
I'm with you.
Yeah.
But I will always say, let's focus on the function. What is it doing?
What is it doing?
What is it doing? Always the what, not just the what, but the why.
Yeah.
Because that's how we choose.
right? We choose for reasons. Thank you.